Congo is a kingdom which sits in West Central Africa. Just to be clear, firstly, because the names of nation states can sometimes confuse, it was not located in what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. It was actually located in what's now the north of Angola. And it seems to have arisen around about the late 14th century. The historian John Thornton, who's done the most detailed analysis of the oral histories and written histories of the Old Kingdom of Congo, suggests that kind of time period. One of the things which is very important about Congo is that it was at the confluence of both trade routes and geographical areas. It was between geographical areas, so it was between the rainforests of Congo, the dry mountains, which you find in what's now Angola, which are also quite suitable for cattle raising, and of course the coastal areas, which are also very important, particularly of course for salt, which is fundamental to all human societies. So it's at the confluence of different trade routes, and that I think is an important explanation perhaps for how Congo arose where it did. It also arose not only because of that geographical framework, just also to say that it was the capital of the Kingdom of Congo, Mbansa Congo, had a large population prior to the arrival of Portuguese traders in the 1480s, probably between 20 and 30,000. So it is already an established, powerful kingdom before then. It also, I think, arises because of the strong clan-based aristocracy which had emerged over the 200 or 300 years before the arrival of European traders in the 1480s, the aristocracy of Congo, known as the Mwisi Congo, and the familial structures and political structures which were related to how the Mwisi Congo had developed their framework of power, had developed, for example, an economic framework with currencies known as the Zimbu shells, which were fished in Luanda, in what's now the capital of Angola, and actual trading connections that the Mwisi Congo had been able to develop with cattle traders, for example, towards the south in what's now Angola, but also forest traders from the north of the Congo River. There was an important market at what was known as Malebo Pool, which is the part of the Congo River which now separates the cities of Kinshasa and Brazzaville. And so the clan structure of the Congo Kingdom, of the Mwisi Congo, the way in which that allowed them to develop both powerful networks within their kingdom, but also trading networks and the different geographical zones, all I think helped to explain the rise of the Kingdom of Congo. By the 15th century, you had this central core in Mbansa Congo, the capital city, which was home to the Mwisi Congo, the aristocracy, and then you had the rural areas, which were known as the Vata. And by the time that Portuguese arrived in the 1480s, you have a federal structure. There are many different provinces, some of which are more important than others. Nsundi was the province where the key market at Malebo Pool, which I've mentioned, was located. Nsoyo was near the coast at the port of Mpinda, which became more and more important, actually, in the 16th and 17th centuries. So you had a very clear political structure. The Mwisi Congo, the aristocracy, would send delegates to be the governors of different provinces, and they would have a relationship to Mbansa Congo, the capital, and then you'd have the production which emerged from the Vata, from the rural areas. And there was a clear structure, and also you had an economic structure through the currency of the Zimbu shell. So all of those things helped to create a really quite a powerful economic and political framework by the 15th century. You also have a very strong religious framework. The priests, Nganga, had a very important role at Mbansa Congo, for example. They retained religious power in a way in which actually in some ways perhaps presented a rival framework of power to that which the rulers, the Mani Congos themselves, had. So essentially there's a slow spread of Bakongo culture, religious culture, the framework of lineage, which explains how the Mwisi Congo themselves established power. And the political spread of that was crystallized through the provinces which the governors sent out from Mbansa Congo themselves helped to rule. The Catholic Church was very important in Congo's history. The Portuguese arrived in the 1480s, and initially there was a conversion of the Mani Congo they came into contact with, Nzinga Nkulu, who was named in Portuguese João I, John I. But the fundamental moment in the history of the Catholic Church in Congo came in the early 16th century, when there was a civil war between rival factions. On Nzinga Nkulu's death, there was a civil war between rival factions, and the victorious faction, the leader of that faction, was known as Afonso I, and he was, by all the sources we have, all the accounts tell us, he was an extremely devout Catholic. He constantly asked for more missionaries and more priests. He would write a very long, detailed, and quite moving accounts of elements of the Christian liturgy. And he fundamentally turned Congo into a Catholic kingdom, certainly for the aristocracy. That was a very important aspect. It was very much an aristocratic religion. It was the religion of the Mwisi Kongo. In fact, we have accounts of some Mwisi Kongo complaining, saying that the Portuguese were converting some people to Catholicism, but not everybody, and themselves demanding conversion. The Portuguese initially helped. They sent missionaries, they sent priests, they sent stonemasons, for example, to help with the building of churches in Banza Congo. But over time, particularly over the 16th century, the religious devotion of those priests, it was clear, was not all that it might have been. There were many complaints from Congo, repeated complaints from Congo, in fact, and actually requests for more missionaries in the 17th century to the Vatican. Various different Mani Congos wrote asking for more missionaries, and it was finally in the 1640s that the Vatican would send more Capuchin missionaries to Congo. At the same time, we have to be clear that there were quite significant ideological divisions which emerged from this. Those who did observe Christianity and Catholicism, saw themselves as Catholics, generally in the aristocracy, were literate, could engage in very learned discourses in Latin, as we know from documents in the 17th century, about elements of Christian theology. And many people in the population at large who might worship the cross in various aspects might receive baptism, but did so through the lens of a Congo religiosity. One of the reasons why Christianity may have been appealing to Congo peoples was that there was the place of the cross was also important in Congo religious symbolism. And there were various ways in which Congo peoples could observe Christianity while in many ways not fundamentally transforming their own religious worldviews. So that was also an important part of how the Catholic Church had developed in Congo. The Mani Congo was initially very successful. They controlled powers, I've mentioned. They were the rulers prior to the arrival of the Portuguese. And actually, their power became more and more important during the 16th century. Congo as a kingdom expanded in the 16th century. It became more centralized. It was able to charge more tax, have more officials, and there was more trade. But over time, as the slave trade became more important, it provoked tensions within Congo. It also provoked the rise of potential rivals. For example, the province of Soyo, which I've mentioned, where the port of Mpinda was, in many ways became a sort of breakaway province by the 17th century and didn't really observe fealty to the centre of Mbansa Congo. So that was a source of division. And the Mani Congos were also unable to stem rebellions within the kingdom, often owing to multiple potential claimants to the throne and also to the divisions provoked by the slave trade. So in 1568, for example, there was a very serious rebellion called known to historians as the Jaga Rebellion, which appears to have come from people who rose up because of the ways in which the rising slave trade was affecting social and kin relations in Congo. So there were actually, initially, Mani Congos saw the Atlantic trade as a way of cementing power. It actually also provoked many fragilities, which in the end challenged the success of the Mani Congos. To start with, as I've mentioned, the Mani Congos were very keen on the relationship with the Portuguese and tried to develop it. And that was particularly under the Mani Congo I mentioned, Afonso I. When he died in 1546, by that time, already the relationship was beginning to sour. And certainly in the second half of the 16th century, Congo became less and less keen to develop its relationships with the Portuguese. Often we would find letters from Mani Congos dismissing the priests and saying how bad their influence had been in Congo. By the early 17th century, essentially, Congo and Portugal are no longer allies, and Congo turns towards the Dutch and begins to send out feelers for Dutch relations before 1610. The Dutch had begun to trade along the West African coast in the 1590s. They didn't trade in the slave trade until the 1630s. Initially, it was a trade in cloth, and cloth was a very important manufacture in Congo, and that was the initial trade with the Dutch. However, in 1630, a fundamental change happens. The Dutch conquer the northern provinces of Brazil from the Portuguese and begin a slave trade. They conquer Luanda from the Portuguese in 1641 because they want access to the slave markets of the Portuguese in what's now Angola. This didn't affect Congo. Congo was still an ally of the Dutch and remained an ally of the Dutch in the wars of the 1640s. But at the same time, the transformation of the Dutch from a trading ally with no interest in the slave trade to a slave trading nation was a fundamental transformation which Congo couldn't control. The Dutch were defeated by the Portuguese in Luanda in 1648, and that was a devastating blow to Congo because they were then allies against the Portuguese and the slave trading interests. And after that, Congo's relationship with Portugal became more and more fragile, and eventually the Portuguese destroyed the Congo aristocracy at the Battle of Mbuila in 1665, which triggered the civil wars in Congo and really the decline of the kingdom in the later 17th century. So we have a combination of different factors. The first of the key factors I've mentioned really already in Congo, you have the growing geopolitical competition over the slave trade between the Portuguese, the Dutch, and in the later 17th century, the English, and the fact that Congo was already weakened internally by the pressures which the slave trade had provoked in Congo. And a very good example of that is the Jaga uprising of 1568 and the fact that only by turning to the Portuguese were the Manicongos able to put that uprising down. So that had very much weakened Congo, weakened Manicongos. And although the first part of the 17th century saw a reaction to that, and in fact in a battle of 1622, Congo was able to defeat the Portuguese, that long-term trend was impossible for any kingdom in Africa, in fact, to challenge, and certainly for Congo. I think a second important factor, which isn't often mentioned by historians, is that the 17th century was a global period of crisis, and many historians, for example, the historian Geoffrey Parker, would now argue that was to do with the environmental crises. It was the era of the mini ice age, which is known to those who are interested in British history. But actually, the mini ice age had many important impacts in Africa. In Congo, it led to a huge loss of harvests, for example. It led to collapse in rainfall and many droughts. And that was also a factor which I think affected how the instability in Congo, the political instability, the migrations, the wars, and therefore the existence of captives for the slave trade. And I think a final thing which needs to be brought in to bear in terms of the tensions which led to the collapse of Congo is that there was a fundamental and irreconcilable contradiction between, on the one hand, you had this centralizing form of government, the rise of the state, which was related to taxation, warfare, the provincial control, and which was trying to grow with the Atlantic trade. And on the other hand, you had the traditional mode of government, which had existed prior to that, which, as I've mentioned, was clan-based and structured around the family structure, the lineage structure. And that tended to fragment central power. So you had this conflict between the demands which external trade presented and which shaped a certain type of political organisation and the forms of political organisation which were those of Congo prior to that. And that conflict, I think, was one of the causes of the collapse of Congo. It's what one historian, Antonio Custodio Gonçalves, has called the lineage against the state. Congo's legacy is very powerful. Congo's legacy is powerful not only in Congo, but also in the Americas. So if you look at the transatlantic slave trade database at slavevoyages.org, you'll see that roughly 40 to 45% of Africans who were captives in the transatlantic slave trade came from the region of West Central Africa. Now, they didn't all come from the Kingdom of Congo, but they came from areas which were related to Congo, and Congo cultures were therefore very influential in the shaping of New World cultures. And there's been quite a lot of research done by historians on that, for example, in terms of religious practice, in terms of what we now think of as martial arts like capoeira in Brazil, in terms of dance. There are lots of ways in which Congo cultures were very influential in forming New World cultures. In West Central Africa itself, and in the region around Congo, Congo remained a powerful kingdom, remained an influential kingdom into the 18th century, although much diminished. I think its role as an early convert to Christianity, I think, is also an important aspect of its influence in shaping a kind of Creole identity in this part of Africa, in Angola, for example, which is still important to this day. So there are various different ways in which Congo's legacy endures.